We mentioned last night, one of the exciting things we have at the festival this year is we've invited 70 remarkable people from around the world who are engaged in meaningful ways, typically in NGO or community activities. And we're asking many of them just to share in a couple of minutes their own big idea on the area that they're most passionate about. And this morning you're going to hear from Jesse Tolkien, who's Executive Director of the Programs for the Energy Action Coalition, which is a coalition of about 50 youth organizations all over North America, and has spurred really a generation-wide movement on climate change, and it's extraordinarily exciting. And following her is John Holdren, who, after last night, needs no introduction, one of the foremost climate scientists in the world, a professor at the Kennedy School, director of the Woods Hole Laboratory. And I really don't want to take any more time. As he told you last night, we only have 10 years to solve this problem, so I don't want to take any more time right now. So first, we're going to hear from Jesse.
Good morning, everybody. It is such an honor for me to be here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. In the spirit of only having 10 years, I think we need big ideas and we need even bigger action. And that's why I'm so excited to be able to present one of many big ideas that I have and that young people around this country have for combating what I think is the defining challenge of our generation, and that is solving global climate change. My big idea is for us not to unite around the problem, although the problem is incredibly significant and complex, and there are many brilliant scientists and professors that we will hear from that can really help us understand the problem. But with only 10 years, what we need to unite around is the solution. And that's why I stand here today so optimistic and so poised and excited for what it would mean for the United States of America to unite around a solution, what it would mean for the international community. I envision a green, clean energy future in which we have created millions of new green jobs that are pathways out of poverty for millions of Americans. I envision an economy in this country where we've actually put people back to work in the manufacturing sector because we are leading the way with technology and innovation in the wind and solar fields. I envision a world in which the United States has become a leader once again in the international community. I envision a group of people fighting climate change that is as diverse as my generation, the most diverse generation in American history. If we are going to do what we need to do in the next 10 years, it will take unprecedented action. It will take unprecedented action from people in this room, every single one of you. If you're here today, you should be leaving feeling that you have a commitment to fight for the clean and just energy future. All across this country, on more than 1,000 college campuses, the Energy Action Coalition has united future business leaders, young people of color, people of faith, people in indigenous communities, on historically black colleges and universities. We have all come together with a united mission to fight for global justice and global climate change. I present to all of you, let's organize in all 300,000 precincts in America. Let's not wait for the next leader. You are the next leader. Leave today, ask your neighbors to get involved, and let's make sure that as we have this historic election in 2008, that climate change is a defining issue, and that in the first 100 days of a new presidency, the people of the United States of America make sure that we are charting the right course forward. Thanks so much, and I look forward to speaking with you over the course of the next many days.
Well, thank you, Jesse. You remind us why there is hope. Many people after my remarks last night said that was terribly demoralizing. I will be elaborating on some of the demoralizing aspects, but I will end with some of the uplifting possibilities consistent with what you just heard. This is a wordier PowerPoint than is ordinarily desirable, and the reason for that is I want to be able to distribute it as a self-contained story to anybody who wants it. So forgive the occasional wordiness in the slides. The benefit is anybody who gives me an email address, I'll be happy to email you the PowerPoint I believe in recycling. You can use any of my slides without attribution. In quick summary, what I'm going to cover this morning are about 6 points. The first I mentioned last night, global warming is a misnomer. What we're experiencing is global climatic disruption. That disruption is growing more rapidly than the scientific consensus was recently predicting. We're already experiencing serious harm. We have only 3 options in this situation: mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. And the less mitigation and adaptation we do, the more suffering we're going to be doing. The goal of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the law of the land in this country and 190 others, is avoiding dangerous anthropogenic, that is, human interference in climate. That goal is already lost. The question now is, can we avoid catastrophic interference? The best chance of achieving that, the best chance of avoiding catastrophic interference in the climate, is stabilizing the human influence on the climate as far below 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent, and I'll explain in a few minutes what that means, as far below that level of atmospheric intervention as we possibly can. And the last point, even 5 years further delay in getting on with serious action is going to make exceeding that threshold almost inevitable. Okay, here's the elaboration. First of all, why is global warming a dangerous misnomer? It implies something that's uniform across the planet, global, mainly about temperature, warming, gradual, as warming also implies, and quite possibly benign. Most people think, what could be so bad about a little warming? The reality is highly non-uniform geographically. We'll see more about that in a minute. It's not just about temperature. It is rapid compared to the capacity of ecosystems and human societies to adjust, and it is harmful for most people in most places for most time to come. We should, therefore, be calling it what it really is, global climate disruption. I want to explain a little bit why the average temperature of the planet, which is the index scientists use to describe how far along this path we are, is not, in fact, the whole story or even the main story. One needs to understand that climate is the pattern of weather. Weather is what's happening here and now. Climate is what we expect to happen based on averages, extremes, timing, geographic distribution in these patterns of not just temperature, but all these other climatic variables: cloudiness, humidity, precipitation, snowpack, snowmelt, how hard the wind blows, how strong the storms are. And when you talk about climate change, what you're talking about is disrupting those patterns. The global average surface temperature is just an index of the state of the global climate as expressed in those patterns, in very much the same way as the temperature of your body is an index of the state of your body. If you go from 98.6 to 104, you don't say, gee, that's just a few degrees, what difference does that make? You know 104 is perilous for your body. That temperature reflects a drastic change in the condition of your body, and the same thing is true of the climate. Small changes in degrees represent big changes in the climatic patterns on which we depend. The spatial distribution of the heating is, as I mentioned, highly non-uniform. This shows the distribution around the globe of the warming that had occurred by the period 2001 to 2005 versus a baseline period of 51 to 80. The average temperature increase in that period was just 5/10 of a degree C, that is a little under 1 degree Fahrenheit. And yet you see that the changes in the far north and in parts of the Antarctic Peninsula were 3 to 4 times the global average change, and in the mid-continents in the whole northern hemisphere, they were 2 times the global average change. When you change heating in an uneven way, that changes wind patterns. This is an example. The East Asia monsoon, which is crucial to crop production and river flows in East Asia, has been weakening steadily for 30 years. It's been weakening in exactly the pattern predicted by Chinese climate models. These data were first shown to me by the deputy head of the climate office in the National Development and Reform Commission in China. These are not data that Westerners are telling Chinese they have to pay attention to. These are data that the Chinese have figured out. Precipitation patterns change when you heat unevenly. The global average in a warming world is increased precipitation and an increased fraction of that precipitation falling in extreme events. But some places are getting drier, much drier. These are the trends over the 20th century. The size of the circles are the amount of the change. The biggest circles are a 50% increase in total precipitation if they're green, and a 50% decrease in total precipitation over the 20th century if they're orange. It's a big deal. What's at risk with these changes? Well, climate governs, and as a result, climate disruption affects a great many things we need to care about. Indeed, climate is the envelope within which all other environmental conditions and processes have to function. And if you distort that envelope enough, which we are well on our way to doing, you distort all those other conditions and processes. You affect the availability of water around the planet, the productivity of farms and forests and fisheries, the prevalence of oppressive heat and humidity, especially in our cities and in the summer. You affect the formation and dispersion of air pollutants. It gets smoggier when it gets hotter. The geography of disease, what vectors and pathogens can live in what abundance, in what environments. You affect the damages that we have to expect from storms, floods, droughts, and wildfires. The property losses we have to expect from sea level rise. How much money we have to spend on engineered environments. How much of the environment do we have to air condition? How many dams? How many dikes? How many storm surge barriers? How much money for all of that? And it affects, finally, the distribution and abundance of all the species on the planet, the ones we love and the ones we hate. The Earth is getting hotter. There's no doubt about it. This is the picture of what climatologists call the instrumental record, the period, the last 125 years, when there were enough thermometers spread over enough of the Earth's surface that you could meaningfully define the global average surface temperature. To go back further than that, you have to use what are called proxies for the temperature. You're studying corals, ice cores, fossil pollens, tree rings, lots of other things. But the direct measurement of the average surface temperature of the Earth goes back 125 years, and this is it. What you see is that the hottest year in the 125 was 2005. 2007 was tied with 1998 for second. The 14 hottest years in the 125 all occurred since 1990. 24 out of 25 of the hottest years all occurred since 1980. If you're a statistician, you can calculate in the margin of your programs what the probability is that such a pattern would materialize at random. It is not random. The fact is, we know exactly what is causing that heating, and this rather busy diagram shows how we know it, and I want to take just a minute to explain it to you. In the top pattern, we have plotted for the same 125 years, the 125 years since 1880, the trajectories of all of the known influences on the global climate. The human influences, the red trajectory on the top is the growing concentration of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, primarily driven by human activities. The black line is black carbon, or more simply, soot, also put into the atmosphere largely by human activities, by diesel engines, inefficient two strokes, biomass burning, and so on. The wavy blue line that goes negative is volcanic eruptions, a natural phenomenon which inject reflecting particles into the atmosphere and cool the Earth for a few years after each eruption until the particles injected fall out of the stratosphere. The solar variation is in there. Natural variation in the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth is a sort of a pale orange wavy curve running through the middle. The solar influence, by the way, the best estimate of that is it is about 1/30th of the influence of the human-produced greenhouse gases and black soot, 1/30th. People who tell you there are still a few floating around who have unaccountably PhDs asserting that the sun is doing this are smoking dope. The sun is not doing this. The sun is 30 times too small to be doing this in terms of the change in the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth over this period. Now, what happens when you plug those, what we call forcings, in climate change? Forcings literally mean how hard are you pushing on the climate in different ways. You put those influences in the top panel into a current state-of-the-art model of the global climate, and it reproduces virtually exactly the 125 years of temperature observations that we have measured. That's the bottom panel. And what you see there, the observations are in blue with asterisks at the highs and lows. The computer runs are in various colors, and the average of the computer runs is the black line running right through the middle of the temperature record. It is impossible to look at this picture and understand it and not accept that we know what's going on. We know what is influencing the global climate. The same computer models capture the essentials of long-term climate change from natural causes. This is a picture of the last 450,000 years of average surface temperature as deduced from the study of ice cores compared to what the same computer model in blue predicts for that period given the natural forcings, changes in the Earth's orbit, changes in the sun over that period. And you can see again that the fit is extraordinary. It's not perfect. There are things about the natural system that we still cannot adequately model. But you look at that fit, and you have to say we know what's going on. This is 450,000 years of natural climate change, accurately modeled. And we have the 125 years of the instrumental record with the human influences in there also accurately modeled by today's computer models. Furthermore, there is no doubt whatsoever that the increases in greenhouse gases, the most important two of which are carbon dioxide and methane, have been caused by human activity. What is shown in the main panels here is 10,000 years, the last 10,000 years of concentrations of carbon dioxide, that's on top, and methane on the bottom, and then in the inset panels, the last 250 years expanded of those things. And what you see is that very slow natural changes in carbon dioxide and methane concentrations over millennia, over 10,000 years, turned into drastic increases with the onset of large-scale deforestation and fossil fuel burning after 1750. We know exactly what happened. We know humans are responsible, furthermore, for the bulk of the CO2 addition coming from the fossil fuels because fossil fuel carbon dioxide differs isotopically from the rest of the carbon dioxide circulating in the system, and you can see the growing influence of the fossil fuel contribution in the atmosphere. But it's now happening, as I suggested last night, even faster than was expected. This shows CO2 emissions growth versus the projections in the previous report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The most recent report came out last year in 2007. The projections from 2001, high to low, or the various colored curves here, and the black curve is what actually happened. And look what happened in 2005 and 2006. CO2 emissions are above the highest projections of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of only a few years ago. The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is growing ever more rapidly. Here you see the numbers, up to almost 2 parts per million per year. 2007 concentration, about 384 parts per million, 38% above the pre-industrial level. And the increases, not surprisingly, in temperature and sea level have been at the high ends of the scenario range put forward by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2001. This is temperature on top, the actual data, the bouncy curve, and sea level on the bottom, again, the actual level, the bouncy curve, up at the high end of the IPCC projections. Not surprisingly, given the distribution of these temperatures geographically, the shrinkage of sea ice in the Arctic is accelerating. This is very interesting. The magenta line is the long-term extent of summer sea ice, September sea ice, for as long as there has been a satellite record able to tell us exactly what that area was. In 2005, the low extent of summer sea ice in the Arctic, which is depicted in the left panel, set a new record, the smallest amount of sea ice ever observed in the satellite era. Prior to 2005, the estimates of sea ice experts were that the sea ice might disappear entirely, which, by the way, would cause drastic changes in the atmospheric circulation of the entire northern hemisphere. Sea ice disappears entirely, maybe by 2070. Then 2007 comes along. You look at the picture for 2007, incredible shrinkage of sea ice compared to 2005. Suddenly, the estimate became 2013, okay? 2070 to 2040 to 2013. The latest reports out in the last few days suggest that the sea ice might disappear entirely this year. 2070, 2040, 2013, maybe 2008. Drastic acceleration in the pace of this problem. Melting of the great ice sheets on land is also increasing. I don't know quite why this got distorted in the projection, but this is Greenland. In 1992, 2002, and 2005, and the orange areas show the extent of surface melting of ice on Greenland in July. 2002 set a record. Again, for as long as we've had observations capable of determining this, 2002 was the largest extent of summer melting of this land ice that had ever been seen. 2005 completely shattered the record, as you see here. The data aren't incompletely, have not been completely analyzed for 2007, but the ice experts at NOAA say that 2007 will beat 2005 by at least 10%. In other words, a new record, further acceleration in the extent of melting. The disruption is already causing real harm to humans and human values. I told you before about the weakening East Asia monsoon. That has meant less moisture flow north to south to north over China. That has produced increased flooding in the south, increased drought in the north, to the detriment of crop production and human welfare in that country. In fact, the incidence of severe flooding is sharply up all over the world. This is severe floods decade by decade from the 50s through the 90s. Astonishing rate of increase of severe flooding, associated not only with the increase in average precipitation, but with the well-understood phenomenon that in a warming world, more and more of the precipitation, larger and larger fraction, falls in extreme events, which means less of it soaks into the ground, more of it runs off, causing floods. And by the way, this also contributes, paradoxically, to an increase in droughts, because the increased runoff means less percolation into the ground, less soil moisture, faster drying in between rainfall events from the higher temperatures. And so you get the worst of both worlds. You get more floods and you get more droughts, as we will see. Wildfires, increasing every place in the world where wildfires have been a problem. In the western United States, wildfires are up fourfold in the last 30 years. Wildfires are extremely sensitive to the conditions of temperature and soil moisture that are affected by the climate disruption that we're talking about. Storms, tropical cyclones, typhoons in the Pacific, hurricanes in the Atlantic. What is shown here is work by Kerry Emanuel at MIT, Professor Emanuel, one of the world's leading authorities on hurricanes. What he figured out is that what's important about a hurricane is not just whether it is Category 3 or Category 4 or Category 5. What's important is how long it stays in those categories and over what area. That determines the total energy released by the storm and the total potential of damage for that storm. And when you correlate that variable, the total energy dissipated by the storm, with sea surface temperatures in the regions that spawn those storms, you get the comparison shown here. The sea temperature is in blue. The power dissipation of the storms is in green. Again, it's very hard to look at these data and say, gee, something else is causing the increase in the power of tropical storms. There are other influences. Again, the fit is not perfect. It's complicated. We could talk for hours just about the genesis and strengthening of tropical storms, but you look at these numbers and the bottom line is we are making tropical storms worse. The Amazon is drying and burning. Places we used to call the moist tropics are the humid tropics. Places that were too wet to burn are now burning. It's happening in the Amazon, it's happening in Indonesia, it's happening in Malaysia. That drying results from the combined effects of local deforestation, which has a drying effect, and altered atmospheric wind patterns, which change the amount of water brought in from the ocean. Those changes are linked to global climate change. The areas you see in yellow and gold here are areas of high flammability in the year 1998, which was a particularly hot year, as you already saw. These trends are increasing. The World Health Organization, which is rather conservative about these matters, did an analysis that said already in the year 2000, global climate change was responsible for more than 150,000 premature deaths around the world, deaths from heat waves, from floods, from droughts, from the expanded ranges of malaria and dengue fever, 150,000 people per year already in 2000. The World Health Organization is soon going to come out with a new estimate, and it is sure to be much higher. and bigger disruption is coming. These are the 2007 scenarios of the IPCC. One may hope that they really span the possibilities and will not again be exceeded by experience, but these are the 2007 scenarios. The black is the historical record, global average surface temperature. The line at 2 degrees C above the 1990 level is the target set by the European Union in 2002, a target that the European Union concluded the world should strive not to exceed. And what you see is in the mid-range scenarios of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world will careen through that target in 2050. And by the way, the last time the world was as warm as that was 130,000 years ago, and sea level was 4 to 6 meters. 4 to 6 meters, call it 20 feet in round numbers, higher than it is today. In the mid-range scenarios, by 2100, we will be 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. The last time the world was that warm was 30 million years ago in the Eocene, when my colleague, the paleoclimatologist Dan Schrag at Harvard, likes to say there were crocodiles swimming off of Greenland and palm trees in Wyoming. In addition, sea level then was 20 to 30 meters higher than it is today. By the way, the gold line at the bottom, which looks like the one we ought to be on, is what you get if you could instantaneously freeze the concentrations in the atmosphere at today's level. We have no way to do that. But even if we did, what the gold curve shows, and I'll say more about this later, is that the temperature continues to coast up for decades. At any given moment in a warming world, you're not experiencing the full consequences of what you've already done to the atmosphere because of the lag before the ocean catches up. Where we're headed in terms of impacts, one big one is heat waves. This is a stunning diagram. Again, it takes a moment to explain, but what you've got here is a depiction of the temperature anomaly in France and Italy and Spain in midsummer. And on the left, you have the historical record and computer simulations of same. And the asterisk on a little spike just past 2000 is the heat wave that killed 35,000 people in 2003. 35,000 people in industrialized countries. 35,000 people in France and Italy and Spain died in the summer of 2003 because it was so hot. And then you look at the computer simulations of where we're going under business as usual. And what you find out is that that heat wave in 2003, which was a 1 in 250-year event before humans started fiddling with climate, was a 1 in 100-year event by the year 2000, will be a 1 in 2-year event in 2040. That is, you'll expect a heat wave that bad every other year. And by 2070, on the business-as-usual projection, the heat wave that killed 35,000 people in 2003 will be an unusually cool year in Central Europe. Higher temperatures mean more smog. This is the correlation for Los Angeles, temperature and daily maximum ozone concentration. Agriculture. Crop yields in the tropics start dropping when the local temperature increase, not the global average, but the local temperature increase gets between 1 and 1.5 degrees C. These are the figures, simulations for rice and corn. Based on increased rainfall and including CO2 fertilization. CO2 is a nutrient. CO2 concentration in the atmosphere goes up. Many plants do a little better, but they don't do enough better to offset the effects of heat stress once you get past a degree to a degree and a half. Temperate zone, again, yields start dropping between 1 and 2 degrees C. They drop more slowly than they do in the tropics, but they do drop. And the important thing is that not only are there no droughts in these projections, but there are no pests, because we don't yet know how to model quantitatively the effect of a warmer, wetter world on pests. They're not in these models. But we know that pests do better in a warmer, wetter world, and that the projections are therefore underestimates of how much agricultural productivity will fall. You look at the droughts. These are drought projections for the last part of this century based on a mid-range scenario. All you have to know about this scale is that yellow is droughts getting much worse, orange to red is horrible, brown is total disaster, and you look at this drought pattern forecast for the latter part of this century, and it is awful. Among other things, you basically lose the Amazon in this picture, but much more. The oceans are acidifying as well as warming. This is a phenomenon that was neglected until relatively recently. But what happens is when you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, some of it gets absorbed in the surface layer of the ocean, doesn't all stay in the atmosphere. What gets absorbed in the ocean makes carbonic acid. Carbonic acid lowers the pH of the ocean. That makes it harder on organisms that make their shells or skeletons out of calcium carbonate, including corals, including shrimp, including all the crustaceans. The ocean pH has already fallen worldwide by a tenth of a pH unit. That doesn't sound like much, but the pH scale is logarithmic. That's about a 30% increase in hydrogen ion concentration. Projected increase is another quarter of a point over this century. It's going to be a big deal. Where we're headed in terms of sea level. We know if we melted the whole Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet, sea level would go up by 70 meters. That's how much water is in those huge, multi-thousand-foot-thick ice sheets. The conventional wisdom has been that that would take thousands of years, even in a much warmer world. But we now know from careful studies of the geologic record that twice in the last 19,000 years, sea level has gone up by 2 to 5 meters per century under natural forcings weaker than the forcings that humans are imposing today. Nobody can tell you, with both hands above the table, whether it is highly likely or unlikely that sea level rise in that ballpark of 1, 2, 3, 5 meters a century could occur in this century or the next. We are not able to model the processes that can produce such rapid disintegration of the ice, but we know it has happened in the geologic past. If you only lost the Greenland ice sheet, that's what GIS stands for here, you see what happens to Florida in the panel on the upper right. If you only lose Greenland, that's 7 meters of sea level rise, 23 feet. If you lose Greenland and the most vulnerable part of Antarctica, which is the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, WAIS, you get 12 meters of sea level rise, and now Florida is a shriveled hulk. If you lose the whole shooting match, all of Antarctica, all of Greenland, probably take many centuries. 70 meters of sea level rise, the coastline of the United States is unrecognizable. This is one that I like to show. It's an animation by one of my doctoral students. I like to encourage everybody to think about what sea level means where you live. This is what sea level rise means where I live, Cape Cod and Boston area, quite dramatic. Okay, as I've already suggested, there are really only three options. Mitigation, that means things you do to reduce the pace and the magnitude of the changes in global climate that human activities are causing. Adaptation means things you do to reduce the impacts on human well-being that result from the climate changes you're not able to avoid. And the third option is suffering the adverse impacts that are not avoided by either mitigation or adaptation. A couple key points about this. We're already doing some of each. We're doing some mitigation, trying to slow the use of fossil fuel combustion, change the technologies. We're doing some adaptation, changing cropping patterns, trying to strengthen defenses against tropical diseases, and we're doing some suffering. I showed you what some of the forms of suffering are. What's up for grabs is the future mix. We're going to do more of all of them. We're going to do more mitigation, more adaptation, and more suffering, inevitably, but the mix is still up to us. A mitigation-only strategy is not an option because we cannot stop climate change in its tracks no matter how much mitigation we do. We need adaptation, too. But an adaptation-only strategy is not an option because the bigger the climate changes to which you're trying to adapt, the more expensive, the more difficult, and the less effective adaptation becomes. How do you adapt to 2 meters of sea level rise if you live on a low-lying island nation? That's not adaptation. That's evacuation. What we need is enough mitigation to avoid unmanageable climate change and enough adaptation to manage the climate change that we are unable to avoid. And that means a lot of both. A lot of adaptation possibilities, changing cropping patterns, developing heat, drought, and salt-resistant varieties, strengthening defenses against tropical diseases, implementing water conservation and new water projects for flood control and drought management, dikes and storm surge barriers against sea level rise, avoiding further development on floodplains and near sea level. Many of these things are win-win options. They're things we ought to be doing anyway, even if we weren't worried about climate change. We should be strengthening defenses against tropical diseases in any case. We should be avoiding development on floodplains in any case. So these are things that perhaps will be relatively easy to start to implement. Mitigation possibilities, certainly we need to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases and soot from the energy sector. We need to reduce deforestation, increase reforestation and afforestation. We need to modify agricultural practices to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases and to build up soil carbon. And there's some other things we might do if we get desperate enough. We might scrub greenhouse gases from the atmosphere technologically. Unfortunately, that's several times more difficult and more expensive than scrubbing the greenhouse gases out of exhausts from power plants, and therefore we're only likely to do it if we get desperate. An even more desperate approach is what's called geoengineering. You try to re-engineer the whole Earth to create cooling effects to offset greenhouse heating. One way to do that would be to inject reflecting particles into Earth orbit to reflect some of the incoming sunlight away and exert a cooling effect to partially cancel the greenhouse warming. Lots of problems with that. Very expensive, unknown side effects, imperfect intervention because it doesn't exactly cancel the effect of the greenhouse gases, and it doesn't do anything about the acidification of the ocean, of course. The leverage for mitigation. This is a picture from the IPCC 2007 report of where the greenhouse gas emissions are coming from, the carbon dioxide, the methane, the nitrous oxide, the chlorofluorocarbons, which are the main classes of greenhouse gases. Something in the range of two-thirds of the whole shooting match is the energy system, the rest largely divided between forestry and agriculture. You look at the biggest emitting countries. In 2005, the United States was the winner, a dubious distinction. China was in second place. China has since overtaken us. China is now the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, although not per capita by any stretch of the imagination, because they have about four times as many capitas as we do. Indonesia and Brazil in third and fourth place, not because of fossil fuel use, but because of huge deforestation rates, followed by Russia, India, Japan, and so on down the list. These are the biggest emitters in the world. Some key realities. The carbon dioxide emissions are the dominant part of the problem. They're cumulatively 50% of what we've done to the atmosphere, and their share is growing. About three-quarters of that carbon dioxide today is coming from burning coal and oil and natural gas, and from those sources is coming 80% of the world's energy. And about one-quarter of the CO2 emissions are coming from deforestation and burning in the tropics. Of what was coming from fossil fuel burning, 60% was coming from industrialized countries in 2006, but China had already passed the United States. The other developing countries are closing fast. And sometime around 2015, the developing countries as a whole will pass the industrialized nations as sources of carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning. That means you've got to do mitigation everywhere. You can't just do it in the industrialized countries. A third reality, you can't change the global energy system overnight, even if you want to. The capital investment in today's world energy system, the power plants, oil refineries, pipelines, transmission lines, drilling rigs, is about $15 trillion. That's what it would cost you to replace today's energy system overnight, and 80% of it is fossil fuel. The normal turnover time for that investment is about 40 years. That means if you want the energy system in 2050 to look a lot different than the energy system looks today, you better start changing it now. And finally, deforestation is also not easy to change because the forces that are driving deforestation are deeply embedded in the economics of food, fuel, fiber, trade, and development. So how much do we need, how soon? I finally get to the title theme of this talk. How much do we need, how soon? I mentioned already that the Framework Convention calls for stabilization at a level that would prevent dangerous human interference. There was, alas, no formal agreement in 1992 when that treaty was concluded as to what that means, what constitutes dangerous human interference. And there was no agreement about what level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere would produce that dangerous interference. Today, there is still no official agreement about that. But clearly, by any reasonable definition of the word dangerous, the current level is dangerous. We are already experiencing serious harm. The question then now is whether we can avoid catastrophic interference. And some relevant points there are that the average surface temperature would go up another half a degree C from the 0.8 of a degree C above pre-industrial where we are now, reaching about 1.3, even if you stabilize concentrations today, which, again, we have no way of doing. Furthermore, potential tipping points into catastrophic change multiply when the average surface temperature goes above about 1.5 degrees. In other words, we're almost today committed to the level of temperature increase, which corresponds to a level above which more and more potential tipping points materialize. Those include the possibilities of rapid disintegration of the ice sheets and corresponding sea level rise, possibility of drastic alteration in ocean circulation, possibility of huge drought and pest impacts on agriculture and forests, possibility of what some people call a methane burp from warming northern soils. There are huge quantities of methane trapped under the tundra and permafrost. And as you melt the permafrost and warm the tundra, that methane starts to come out. There's already evidence of this happening. Methane is 20 times as powerful per molecule as a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. A big methane burp could accelerate every other problem on the list. Limiting the temperature increase to less than 2 degrees C has been widely recognized for the last few years as the most prudent target that still might be available. That's the one the European Union embraced in 2002. To have just a 50% chance of not exceeding that target requires that we stabilize the sum of the human influences on the atmosphere. That means the carbon dioxide, the other greenhouse gases, and atmospheric particles at a level that's equivalent to 450 parts per million of CO2. That is, the same effect as if only CO2 were there and there were 450 parts per million of it. That's called CO2 equivalent or just CO2e. In 2005, we were at 380 parts per million of CO2. We were at 430 parts per million of CO2 equivalent when you put all the greenhouse gases together, but the particle effects offset about 50 parts per million of that. The particle effects are a net cooling. There are more cooling particles than there are warming particles, and the net effect, coincidentally, is that CO2e and CO2 were about equal in 2005 at 380 parts per million. Just recently, one of the world's most distinguished climate scientists, Jim Hansen, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, started arguing that prudence requires a much more ambitious target than 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent. He said we should stabilize the CO2 itself at 350 parts per million. That happens to be the level where CO2 was when Dr. Hansen testified in 1988 before the United States Congress that the evidence of global warming was now compelling. People had known about the phenomenon for decades. I first wrote about it in 1969. Many others have been writing about it for more than a century. But Hansen in 1988 was the first climate scientist of stature to say, we are seeing it. And the concentration at the time he did that was 350 parts per million of CO2, and he wants to go back to there. In other words, reverse course, go well below today's level. If the effects of greenhouse gases other than CO2 and the effects of the particles happen to continue to cancel over time as they have up until now, that would also correspond to 350 parts per million CO2 equivalent. Just a couple of days ago, 2 or 3 days ago, that proposal was endorsed in a statement signed by a long list, a couple hundred names of global luminaries from academia, business, government, and NGOs. It's on the web at www.350.org. All considerations of how much, how soon, need to take into account three unfortunate scientific realities. The first one is that stabilizing the temperature does not immediately stop the growth of impacts. If we stabilized the temperature increase at 2 degrees C, ice would continue to melt for centuries after that, under that higher temperature. Number two, stabilizing atmospheric concentrations doesn't immediately stop the temperature rise. I already mentioned this. That's because of the time lag before the oceans catch up with the changes you've imposed on the atmosphere. Number three, stabilizing emissions doesn't immediately stop the rise of atmospheric concentrations. If you want to stop the rise of atmospheric concentrations, you actually have to cut emissions sharply. Together, those realities mean that growth in temperature and impacts cannot be stopped immediately no matter what we do, and large emission cuts are needed even to stop the temperature increase within decades. And this picture shows how hard it is. This is future carbon dioxide emission paths for stabilization at various levels. The orange at the top is business as usual. That takes us to temperature increases beyond 6 degrees above pre-industrial. The green line in the middle is 550 parts per million. Stabilizing there gives you a 50% chance of staying below 3 degrees C. The gold is 450, 50% chance of stabilizing at 2 degrees. And at the bottom is Hansen's curve. You have to go negative in order to get what Jim Hansen, one of the world's most distinguished climate scientists, say we need. You actually have to start sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. You have to have more net forestation, more net soil carbon buildup, more carbon dioxide sequestration in geologic formations than you have emissions from fossil fuel burning. Huge challenge. And what you see from the timing is for either of those lower curves, for 450 or 350, you have to level off and bend down starting essentially immediately. You have to be declining by no later than 2020, declining by no later than 2020 worldwide, even to be on the 450 part per million curve. Where are we going to get the leverage? You look at the biggest part of the problem, the fossil fuels, and you see the emissions are coming from four places: the number of people, the amount of economic activity, the amount of energy it takes to make a dollar of gross domestic product, and the amount of carbon released in CO2 per unit of energy supply. Real simple, and that means we know what the options for reductions are. You could reduce the growth of energy use by reducing population growth, by reducing the growth of GDP per person, by reducing the amount of energy it takes to make GDP, and there are several different ways to do that listed here, increasing efficiency, changing the mix of economic activity, and you can reduce the ratio of carbon dioxide to energy, again, in a number of ways. You could substitute natural gas for oil and coal. It releases less carbon dioxide per unit of energy. You can replace fossil fuels with renewables. You can replace fossil fuels with nuclear. And you can capture and sequester the carbon dioxide from fossil fuel use. That's the whole option set. That's all there is. There isn't anything we can do in the energy sector that isn't on this list. And there's no panacea in there. Every one of those options has limitations and liabilities. Population, social and political sensitivities, slowing GDP per person, economic aspirations. Nobody wants to stand up and vote for less economic activity. Expanding natural gas, there's not enough natural gas. Wind, intermittency and siting problems. Everybody knows what NIMBY means, not in my backyard. You're seeing that applied all over the place. But we're shifting to what I call banana in the energy business. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody. People are going to have to understand that if you build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody, you're going to plug the plug into the wall and nothing's going to be there. You have to build something, you have to build it somewhere, or you've got no energy. And as I said the other day, without energy, there is no economy. Biofuels. Many forms of biofuel production have net energy problems. They use as much or more energy as they deliver. Competition for land, impacts on food production on ecosystems, photovoltaics, intermittency, cost, in some cases toxic substances. Nuclear fission, cost, waste, safety, proliferation of nuclear weapons. Nuclear fusion doesn't work yet. I started my career working on nuclear fusion. Then I figured out it wasn't going to work before I died, and I went on to other things. Carbon capture and sequestration, expensive, has to be done at a huge scale, complicated. End use efficiency, probably the best option, cleanest, fastest, cheapest, but it's limited by education. People have to know what to do. They have to know what pays. It's an education problem. And there are other barriers in perverse incentives, tax issues, and others. Many people say, where's hydrogen? Hydrogen is not an energy source. It comes from other sources. It's a way to store energy. It's a way to burn it cleanly. But you got to get it from one of the above. If you've got a big problem and no panacea, it means you need a portfolio, not just one thing or two, but many. Not necessarily everything on the menu, but we need to develop everything to its full potential and then see which ones we might be able to do without. We need increased R&D on all of the options to improve them, because we need a better menu for the future than the one we have today to get this done. Some good news and bad news about mitigation. Efficiency is the cheapest, fastest, cleanest, surest source of reductions. Many of those approaches are win-win. They bring big co-benefits. The value of the energy saved is usually more than the cost. There are some supply-side options that are also win-win. Wind, some of the biofuel options. Adaptation is often win-win, as I mentioned. But here's the bad news. The bad news is the win-win options aren't going to be enough. Doing enough mitigation is going to require putting a substantial price on emissions of greenhouse gases via an emissions tax or tradable permits. And you can see this in the supply curve for greenhouse gas emissions reductions developed by the McKinsey Company. Below the line are things that pay with no carbon price. Above the line, and you have to go all the way to the right to be on the 450 part per million trajectory, above the line are things we've got to pay for. And we're not going to pay for them unless there's an incentive for firms and consumers to deploy these technologies that cost money, and that incentive has to be that you're penalized if you emit that CO2 instead of avoiding it in these ways. One of the costliest ones is capturing carbon dioxide from power plants. We're going to have to do it, as costly as it is. What this shows, simply, is that the coal-burning power plants, currently forecasted to be built between now and 2030, will emit in their operating lifetimes as much carbon dioxide as all coal burning in history has emitted up until now. Just the new coal burning power plants. There are that many of them. And if that happens, if those plants are built, and if their carbon dioxide is not captured and stuck down in the ground where it can't get out, we will have no hope of stabilizing atmospheric concentrations below 450 parts per million. There is a huge challenge of scale of how big this has to be. You want to stabilize at 450 means global emissions in 2050 have to be between 7 and 9 billion tons of carbon below the business-as-usual trajectory. Getting 1 billion tons has been figured out by my colleagues Rob Sokolow and Steve Pakala at Princeton, a science article a couple years ago. Just to get a billion tons, all the buildings in the world have to be 20 to 25% better in 2050 than the business-as-usual projection, which already contains a lot of improvement. 2 billion cars have to get 60 miles a gallon instead of 30. 2 billion cars in order to avoid 1 billion tons of carbon. 800 coal-burning power plants have to capture their CO2. 700 new nuclear power plants, that's roughly twice as many as we have in the world today, have to be added to avoid 1/7 to 1/9 of what we need to do by 2050. You need 1 million 2-megawatt wind turbines to do it. You need 2,000 1-gigawatt photovoltaic power plants to do it. It's huge. Nonetheless, it is not unaffordable. If we had to pay $100 a ton to avoid half of our current emissions, and $100 a ton is enough, in all likelihood, to pay for all of the things that I just described, that would be $500 billion a year. It's a lot of money, but it's about 1% of the global world product, and it's not money down a black hole. As the previous speaker, Jesse, suggested, spending this money will create a lot of jobs. Okay? It's investment, it's income, it's wealth. The world today spends 2.5% of gross world product on defense. The United States spends 5% of its GDP on defense, 2% on environmental protection already. We only need another 1%, and we can solve the climate problem. More sophisticated analyses give basically the same answer. Ballpark of 1 or 2% of GDP, we could fix it. That, by the way, if the economists are right and the world economy keeps growing at 3% per year, that means that people in 2100 will have to wait until September 2100 to be as rich as they otherwise would have been in January. Not too high a price to pay for avoiding catastrophe. I'm running out of time here very quickly. Some realities on the policy side. The industrialized countries are going to have to go first, paying more of the upfront costs, offering assistance to developing countries. We're going to have to pay developing countries to reduce their deforestation. If we don't do that, they're going to cut it all down under the current economic incentives. We need a formal and binding agreement for post-2012. Without it, we're not going to get there. And the best basis for such an agreement is probably reductions in the ratio of greenhouse gases to economic product. But in the longer run, this is terribly unpalatable in the U.S. Congress at the moment. In the longer run, the only politically acceptable basis is going to be equal per capita emissions rights. If we don't grasp that nettle, we're not going to get the job done. We need a national climate policy in the United States. Separate policies for 30 states and 300 cities, which is what we've got now, add up to a nightmare for business. We need a level playing field. It's got to be mandatory. Measures that are immediately profitable, of course, will be done voluntarily, but the more expensive stuff is not going to be done. Needs to be stiff, meaning both high emissions charges to bring big reductions and difficult to soften because companies need predictability and the problem's not going away, and it needs to be soon if the world is to avoid catastrophe. I will stop there and thank you very much. We have just a few minutes for questions. I see a question right down here. Yes.
Well, the
10 years comes from the numbers I showed here, that if you want to stabilize the atmosphere at a level that gives you a 50% chance of not going through that 2 degree C point, beyond which the chance of catastrophe escalates very rapidly, then global emissions have to be actually declining by 2020. By 2020, in round numbers. And that's about a decade. They have to be declining by then. For them to be declining by then, we have to be reducing the growth rate starting now. You can't go from growth to decline instantaneously. You have to bend the curve over, and then it comes down. And if you look at the numbers, you find that for that to happen, and allowing for some additional growth in the poorest countries that are going to burn more fossil fuel to try to make some of their people a little better off, then the industrialized countries like the United States have to be declining by 2015. And if you want the United States to be declining by 2015, you better have legislation in the United States in the next 2 years. Or, as I like to say, we're cooked. Let's see. Yeah.
Can go to the microphones because we're this.
Okay, we got microphones. Over here.
I don't know if it's on.
The microphone's not picking you up. Could you talk a little closer to it?
All that you're talking about is very large picture. This is what has to be done.
Right.
How does an individual, like in this community here, where there's a lot of well-to-do people who have many, one, two, three, four, five homes, nobody really knows how to calculate. What is, as an individual, what are you costing in the way of emissions?
Okay. First of all, there is now a tremendous resource available on the web for people to calculate what their own emissions are. Calculate your own carbon footprint, given how many square feet you have, what kinds of appliances you have, what kinds of vehicles you drive, how much you fly per year. And there's also a huge amount of information about what individuals can do to reduce those impacts. Switch out your light bulbs, insulate the houses better, get better windows, turn the thermostat down. Wide variety of things you can do. Secondly, those are individual actions, and they're important, but as my friend Tom Friedman likes to say, while it's important to change your light bulbs, it's even more important to change your leaders. We need political leadership who will get this done. The good news is that both of the current major party presidential candidates have committed themselves to addressing this problem, and I think either one, if elected, would actually do it. That's the good news. I think we are going to have a climate policy of a serious nature in the United States in the next couple of years. You ask what people of means can do. There are a large number of both private think tanks and non-governmental organizations that are doing tremendously important work to figure out how the world can most effectively and efficiently reduce emissions on the scale required, and support for those organizations is very badly needed. And not surprisingly, it has not mostly been coming from the government. In my own organizations, we get some of our funding from the private sector. We get some of it from individuals. We do get some of it from government agencies, NSF, NASA, NOAA, the Department of Energy. But there's a tremendous need for support for the NGOs, the academic institutions that are doing the science, that are doing the policy entrepreneurship, that are doing the activism, that people of means can be immensely helpful with.
I think what I'm trying to say, though, is what is the connection between what I do and what are the levels that I can emit that reach this? You know, you've got a bottle of water sitting up there. That has an effect, yet a lot of people don't recognize
Yes.
how many of those have to be eliminated.
This is a bottle of Fiji water, the producers of which are hosting an event here for the speakers on Wednesday evening. They do have a little notice in the rooms saying that they are offsetting their carbon emissions by 120%, I assume by paying for tropical reforestation. Yes, next.
Hi, What is the status currently of the denial community? Have they been marginalized? Are they still vibrant? That's question one. And question two is, can you give us an assessment of what the effect has been over the last two decades of a substantial number of scientists who say it ain't happening or there's nothing we can do about it?
Okay. Question is about the current status of the denialist community. We used to call them skeptics, but skepticism has a distinguished tradition in science, which these folks have been giving a bad name, and so many of us have been starting to call them denialists, as you just did. There are really very few of them. They have been receiving attention all along, vastly out of proportion to their numbers, to their credentials, and to the merit of their arguments. And that has happened partly because the media in this country love controversy. It's happened to a much smaller extent, interestingly, in Europe and in other parts of the world. But in this country, we seem to love controversy so much that if 3,000 scientists meeting intensively over a period of years say we agree that what the evidence adds up to is the following, and one denialist says it ain't true, the denialist gets equal space in the New York Times. And that's unfortunate. And I think it has set us back substantially. Interestingly enough, it is now true that something like three-quarters of the American public believe that climate change is real, that human activities have something to do with it, and that ultimately it's going to be harmful. But when you ask them to rank the issues that are most important to them, they rank at 18th or 19th, at least when you average over the whole population. I understand that our younger citizens have a much better appreciation of the importance of this issue. And again, we heard about that in the remarks preceding mine. It does strike me as quite an achievement, though, that 75% of the American public believe climate change is real, while only 50% believe evolution is real. So over here on this side.
Yeah. I realize you made it quite clear that none of these things is a single silver bullet, but I wonder what your attitude is about nuclear power. If we're going to have a climate policy, whichever candidate wins, these are plants we know how to build. There have been obviously significant problems with them in the past, but given the catastrophe you've outlined, why not just hit the accelerator and build a bunch of these things instead of coal-powered plants?
My view is that it would be a lot easier to solve this problem with nuclear energy than without it. In order to solve it with nuclear energy, we need to build a lot of new plants, even to take a significant bite out of it, as you saw, to do something like 1/7 to 1/9 of what we need to do between now and 2050. We need to triple the number of nuclear reactors in the world, triple it. And what that means, where the challenge is that we can't just build nuclear reactors in the United States and France. We've got to build them in a lot of places. And that means we've got to break the link between nuclear energy and nuclear proliferation.
Right.
I think we know how to do that, but we have lacked the political will. What you need to do to break that link, and this will be a little technical for some of you, forgive me, we need to put all uranium enrichment in the world under multinational control, not just International Atomic Energy Agency oversight, but multiple countries running each plant and watching each other. Okay? If you have Israel and Syria jointly running a uranium enrichment plant, neither one is going to succeed in hosing any enrichment off into bombs. The United States has been a principal obstacle to agreeing to that. The United States says everybody else should do that, but we're exceptional, we're the good guys, so we'll keep enriching our own. That's not going to fly. Same thing for fuel reprocessing. To the extent that we do any separation of plutonium from used nuclear fuel for the purpose of recycling it, all of those plants need to be under multinational control. Those are the two connections between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons.
But those
we could break them both.
Those are a matter of political will.
That's right.
Said.
We could break them both, and I hope we muster that political will. But given our record so far, I'm not holding my breath.
Have
I hope
talked,
we can
have
get
you
that.
Have you talked to Obama or McCain about this?
Both of them. Yes.
And?
Yes.
And?
I think that at the moment of the two, McCain is certainly much the more enthusiastic about nuclear energy and its prospects. Whether he or Obama will ultimately endorse the measures that we would need to take to make that expansion of nuclear energy practical, I can't say for sure. There's some other issues on waste management that we also need to address, but we could address them if we simply had the political will. The waste problem is much more a political problem than a technical one, but so far we've proved not smart enough to get it done. And so there is some reason for concern.
Thanks.
Yes.
Hello, I'd like to ask a personal question. I mean, it seems like if we have to move that quickly in 10 years, then we have to start immediately. So this is a personal question. I have a lovely Mercedes sedan I bought it 4 or 5 years ago. I only drive it a couple thousand miles a year because I don't drive very much. But I've thought a lot, gee, I should get an electric car, a Prius or a plug-in Prius. That would be great. But I don't need another car, so then I would be selling this car, which basically, since it's a beautiful Mercedes sedan, someone is going to buy and then drive.
They might drive it more than you did. Yeah.
And they might drive it more than I would, so then I would be going backwards. And so I asked myself, should I just take it down to Union Square in San Francisco one day and just ceremoniously take it apart as, you know, and sort of recycle it and say, I'm taking this car and I'm just giving it back? Or what should we do with these things? What are we going to do with a billion cars?
Yes. I think we're actually at the witching hour. I'm looking for the management.
You've got just 2 more minutes.
2 more minutes. All right. Over here.
Is suffering our best hope?
And
what I mean by that is, will the climate disruption disrupt our ability to burn fossil fuels?
Well, I think that the suffering is already being noticed, that people are noticing more storms, more floods, more wildfires. People are being harmed. People are losing their homes. People in the West from wildfires. People in the center of the country from floods. People are increasingly connecting it to climate change. And this is generating an ever more vigorous demand for action. And in that sense, suffering is generating political will. It's a terrible way to get it. I mean, those of us who have been talking about this problem for 4 decades have been very frustrated, because I was saying in 1971, if we wait until there are dead bodies in the streets, the problem is going to be a lot harder to solve than if we start early and make the investments in a more gradual and measured transition to a different energy system. We are getting to the point now where suffering is occurring widely and is becoming a major driver. I would still like to hope that we come to our senses before we actually drive over the cliff. I see nobody else at the microphone. Again, I thank you all very much.